This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Michael Jordan, The Life, written by Roland Lazenby, read by Bob Sauer. Dedicated to the memory of Tony Travis, Roy Stanley Miller, Lacey Banks, L.J. Beatty, and Ed McPherson, brothers, one and all. Prologue. The defender's eyes grow wide, as they well should. He's about to face the kind of kinesthetic brilliance that first motivated humans to invent slow-motion technology, something, anything, that would allow them to review exactly what happens when movement plays tricks on the mind. The setting is painfully familiar. Something in the offensive structure has broken down at the other end of the floor, igniting a fast break. The entire defense is retreating. The defender has sprinted back down the floor, and as he turns, he sees the blur. The dark form in red has the ball, dribbling and winding his way through the chaos at great speed. He crosses the ball over from right to left and draws it up in two hands just off his left hip in mid-stride. At this exact moment, the tongue falls out of his face. Sometimes it shows just slightly between the teeth, but at this moment, the full tongue drops grotesquely, like some comic doll silently mocking the defender. There's a leering, obscene quality to the expression, as if the coming dunk itself won't be insult enough. For ages, warriors have instinctively made such faces to frighten one another. Perhaps there's some of that going on here. Or perhaps it's just what he has said it is, a unique expression of concentration picked up from his father. Whatever, the 22-year-old Michael Jordan gains full clarity now, flashing his tongue at the defender like he is Shiva himself, the ancient god of death and destruction, driving the lane. Just as quickly, the tongue disappears and, as he strides, Jordan pulls the ball up to his left shoulder, then rotates it in front of his face with his two hands as he leaves the floor, just inside the foul line. The defense has collapsed to the lane, but the spindly form is already airborne, floating through them, switching the ball to his mammoth right hand as he approaches the goal. For an instant, his arm is cocked, cobra-like, ready to strike as he glides toward the rim, hanging alone, time seemingly suspended, as he calmly measures the finish. For spectators, the singular thunk of the throwdown is deeply stirring. It elicits a Pavlovian response, perhaps almost carnivorous, like watching a lion devour an antelope on the Nature Channel. The arc of the attack has formed a seemingly perfect parabola from takeoff to landing. In time, physics professors and even an Air Force colonel will take up an intense study of the phenomenon, trying to answer the question that obsessed a global audience, is Michael Jordan flying? They will all measure his hang time and declare that his flight is an illusion made possible by the momentum delivered by his speed at liftoff. The more they talk of extraordinary thigh and calf muscles and fast-twitch fibers, of his center of balance, the more they sound like men grasping at air. Jordan's entire journey from the foul line to the rim lasts barely 1 second. Yes, Elgin Baylor and Julius Erving, too, were capable of extraordinary hang time, but they performed mostly before video technology allowed the audience to savor their feats. Air Jordan was something altogether different, a phenomenon of the age, a departure from the past that surely seemed immune to the future. Of the millions who had played the game, he was the one who could fly. Jordan himself considered the question in those early months of his pro career, after viewing videotape of himself. "Was I flying?" he asked. "It sure seemed like it, at least for a short time." The rarest talent is like a comet streaking briefly across the sky, captured only by the trailing flash of its brilliance. Michael Jordan's entire mesmerizing playing career left fans, the media, his former coaches and teammates, even Jordan himself, still struggling to comprehend what had happened years after he last played. "Sometimes I wonder what it will be like to look back on all of this," he once observed, "whether it will even seem real." Was it real? The time would come in his later years when a plumper Jordan with a drawn face would find himself the target of great ridicule and internet invective over his missteps as an executive or his personal shortcomings. Yet even that couldn't dim the light he had cast as a player, when he was nothing short of otherworldly. In the beginning, he was simply Mike Jordan, just another adolescent from North Carolina with an uncertain future, contemplating a stint in the Air Force after high school. The early 1980s marked his startling transformation into Michael, the Archangel of the Rims. In the process, his persona propelled the rise of Nike's business empire, which soon made him its young emperor, a role that both freed and imprisoned him. He became the very picture of competence. Nobody, it seemed, could do anything quite as well as Michael Jordan played basketball. His competence was exceeded only by his confidence, noted longtime Chicago sportswriter Lacey Banks. The professional game had always struggled against its gritty image, grown men running around in what amounted to underwear. But Jordan elevated all of that with his flight. It was subtle at first, the element of cool he brought to the sport. He soon enough infatuated a worldwide audience, just as American television programming was reaching the apex of its influence. For a generation, his impossibly fetching 1991 Gatorade commercial quickly came to serve as a soundtrack, a mantra. "Sometimes I dream that he is me. You've got to see that's how I dream to be, if I could be like Mike." The convergence of culture and technology had thrust him into this unparalleled role as the soaring godhead of a global sports and merchandising empire, who left just about everyone agog at his spectacle. Art Chansky, the basketball writer who had covered Jordan as something of a regular Joe at the University of North Carolina, recalled his surprise later upon visiting him in Chicago. "I was just amazed in old Chicago Stadium when he had to walk down the aisle between the baseline seats behind the basket to get to the floor. Just the effect he would have on people as he walked by. Grown men and women. You know how much they had to make just to afford those seats to begin with? Just the fact that Michael was within a couple feet of them. I watched their faces, the contortions. It was like the Messiah walking by." Then, in the locker room afterward, the press would be like 10 deep around him. Messiah, indeed. The worship grew so fearsome over the seasons that longtime Bulls PR man Tim Hallam began referring to Jordan as Jesus. Hallam would turn to a publicity assistant and ask, "Have you seen Jesus today?" This evolution had been propelled by a seemingly unshakable good fortune. Ralph Sampson competed memorably against Jordan in college when both were vying to be named the National College Player of the Year, and he watched with fascination his opponent's rise over the ensuing decades. "Yes, Jordan had all of the physical gifts and an unparalleled work ethic," Sampson acknowledged, "but Jordan's abundance of luck could not be overlooked. He was blessed with the best coaches and joined by great teammates. I mean, he worked at the game, and if he wasn't good at something, he had the motivation to be the best at it," Sampson observed in a 2012 interview on the eve of his own selection for the Hall of Fame. "But he also got put in the right situation with the right team, the right coaches that saw his talent and ability, and they put a team around him that worked. So I think it's the combination of all that that has made him." No one was more aware of the extraordinary chain of events that drove his life than Jordan himself. "Timing is everything," he offered, looking back as he neared age 50. Yet timing and luck were merely the foundation of the mystery. Sports psychologist George Mumford was transfixed the first time he observed Jordan's animated approach to practice at age 32. Having heard about his great appetites and how little he slept, the psychologist, who had just begun working for the Bulls, immediately suspected that the star was manic depressive or bipolar, or perhaps even both. "He was frenetic, all over the place with this hyper energy," Mumford recalled of that practice. "I thought, he can't sustain that." Surely Jordan was in the manic stage of some condition, Mumford thought. Manic depressives display periods of extreme highs, followed by profound lows. Over the coming weeks, the psychologist looked closely for signs of depression in the wake of Jordan's highs. But after studying him, Mumford came to realize that the animation and hyper-competitiveness were simply Jordan's normal state. Having played basketball himself at the University of Massachusetts and roomed with Julius Erving, Mumford had plenty of experience around elite talent. But Jordan was clearly something else, Mumford soon decided. The zone of high performance that other athletes struggled to achieve was something that Jordan accessed on a regular basis. "Michael did not have to find something to motivate himself into that state," Mumford explained. "The more you have those moments in the zone, the more you want to have them. Most people can't sustain it. His ability to find that state, his ability to concentrate, His ability to lock in were almost superhuman. He was coming from a different place, man. And in games? He was the eye of the hurricane, Mumford offered. The more frenetic things got, the calmer he was. Jordan would spend much of his early career figuring out how to harness these gifts and to use them in a team format, because above everything else, he badly needed to win. While his flight had first gained the audience's attention, it was his overwhelming competitiveness that allowed him to keep it. Soon enough, the public's fascination turned to his relentless drive, which led him to test almost everyone and everything throughout his career. He tested his friends and sweethearts for loyalty, tested his coaches, tested his teammates to see if their hearts and minds were strong enough to share the floor with him. The more he accumulated, the more he tested. He established a record for being quite harsh in this testing. James Worthy, his friend and teammate from North Carolina, described him as a bully. Jordan would admit as much. "I can be hard," he acknowledged in 1998. Mostly, he tested himself. It seemed that he discovered the secret quite early in his competitive life. The more pressure he heaped on himself, the greater his ability to rise to the occasion. It all added up to immense complexity. Tex Winter, the Chicago Bulls' longtime assistant coach who worked with Jordan longer than any other coach, said that in 6 decades of basketball, he'd never encountered a more complicated figure. "Personality-wise, he's a study, he really is," Winter said of Jordan as their run together was nearing its end. "I guess I don't have the intelligence to grasp a lot of things that make Michael tick, that make him what he is. I think I analyze him pretty good, but he is a mystery man in an awful lot of ways, and I think he always will be, maybe even to himself." That realization was hammered home for many fans in 2009 by Jordan's jarring acceptance speech during his Basketball Hall of Fame induction, when he offered a harsh assessment of so many major figures in his career, including UNC coach Dean Smith. Former colleagues, media commentators, fans, all expressed surprise and dismay in the wake of Jordan's induction. He was not what they had assumed he was in those early years when his image seemed so perfect. They thought they knew him. They did not. Part 1. Cape Fear. Chapter 1. Holly Shelter. The god of basketball, as he would be called by fans worldwide, was born with a bloody nose in Brooklyn, of all places, on the kind of chill February Sunday in 1963 that sent steam rising from the sidewalk sewer grates outside the 10-story Cumberland Hospital. Basketball guru Howard Garfinkel would later enjoy pointing out that the hospital also served as the birthplace for brothers Albert and Bernard King, making it something of a fabled location in a city that treasures its sports figures. Despite the aura of this Brooklyn beginning, it was elsewhere and much earlier that the full force of Jordan's extraordinary life gained its first traction, just before the turn of the 20th century, with the birth of his great-grandfather down on North Carolina's coastal plain. In those days, death seemed to be everywhere. It had a nose to it that crept upstream each morning and curdled with a brackish air. The gulls screamed like banshees in those little shanty towns, where nobody dared take simple survival for granted. That's really where the story of Michael Jordan's life begins, in a shotgun shack on the banks of a Blackwater River that winds among the pine forests and swamps, where the moonshine drips oh so quietly, and the mystery hangs like clumps of gray moss sagging from the trees. The year was 1891, just 26 summers removed from the great violence and confusion of the American Civil War. The place was a little riverside hamlet called Holly Shelter in Pender County, about 30 miles northwest of Wilmington, 40 miles if you rafted down the winding northeast Cape Fear River, as Jordan's ancestors often did. The place supposedly earned its name after Revolutionary War soldiers took refuge under the holly trees there on cold winter nights. The savanna is bordered by swamplands that during slavery's days also provided shelter of another sort for runaways. One of the region's vast plantations was supposedly owned by a white preacher from Georgia named Jordan. With emancipation, many freed slaves gravitated to Holly Shelter. "They settled the swamp," explained Walter Bannerman, a distant Jordan relative. Holly Shelter was nothing but swamp. Soon enough, though, the hard times of the era would render the name devoid of meaning, for there was little shelter to be had. Which was the first remarkable thing about the baby boy.
He arrived on a typically sweltering day in late June 1891, following yet another run of the coastal storms that so often menaced the people living on the river. Coroners recorded staggering numbers of stillbirths and infant deaths in those shotgun shacks, so many, in fact, that families often waited days, even weeks, to name their newborns. This baby, however, was very much alive, evidenced by a squalling that would jolt his mother awake, just as many years later his rich basso profundo would make his fidgety 6-year-old great-grandson Michael snap into focus and behave. The dawn of the Jim Crow era and the politics of white supremacy were breaking across North Carolina with such vengeance that the impact would be felt long after those laws had passed into history. In that world of routine cruelty, Michael Jordan's great-grandfather would live a life of grinding poverty amid relentless racism. Worse yet was the grim death that would take his loved ones and friends and cousins, just about anybody really, infants and little girls and strapping young men, take them all, mostly right in the bloom of life in those coastal communities. But all of these things lay ahead in life for the baby boy. On the day of his birth in June 1891, his 21-year-old mother, Charlotte Hand, was in a bit of a pinch, as she was not married to his father, a man named Dick Jordan. The very concept of marriage was somewhat alien in this shantytown world, as North Carolina law had long forbidden the marrying of slaves, along with most other rights and privileges. The state's laws had been particularly brutish, once allowing, for example, slaveholders to punish any unruly young buck with castration. In the immensely uncertain 1890s, the one thing young Dawson Hand could rely on was his mother's love. He would be her only child, and they would share an abiding affection for many years. After the birth, Charlotte took refuge with her family and raised the boy among the Hands, as they lived first with one brother's family and then another's. For most of the first 2 decades of his life, he would be listed in official documents as Dawson Hand. Yet, as welcome as mother and son were among her siblings, it wasn't long before he grew old enough to notice the glaring contrast. The Hands were light-skinned, so much so that numerous members of the family could pass for white or Indian, while the Jordans were a people of rich chocolate complexion. Of an entire generation of Hand siblings and cousins, only one was dark, family members would recall years later. The White Hands in Pender County were a prominent slaveholding family, and their black offspring long talked of the time that a White Hand man had finally acknowledged the unspoken truth, that one of the Dark Hand men was his brother. This perhaps helps explain why sometime in his teen years, the boy would assume the name of his father and become Dawson Jordan in official records. Dawson Jordan grew into a young man who, at first glance, would seem to have little in common with his statuesque great-grandson. Dawson was short, just 5'5" by some accounts, and stocky. And he was crippled, consigned to dragging a bad leg along with him wherever he went over the course of his long life. But like his great-grandson, Dawson Jordan possessed tremendous physical strength, and he proved equally fearless, with an uncommon toughness, accomplishing feats as a young man that would become the subject of lore in his community for decades after. More importantly, against foes that those in later generations couldn't begin to understand, Dawson Jordan somehow remained unbowed, undefeated. In such an exceptional life, it's easy to overlook the one factor that arguably shaped Michael Jordan's character more than any other. Through most of his formative years, he lived with 4 generations of Jordan men, a substantial accomplishment considering the societal factors that had long threatened the lives of African-American males. His great-grandfather, Dasson, as he was often called, loomed as a figure of authority in the young life of Michael Jordan. The entire family lived together for almost a decade in the farming community of Teachy, North Carolina. Even well into the age of automobiles and 4-lane highways, Dawson Jordan insisted his mode of transportation remain the mule he proudly hitched to his ox cart. Even as an old man, he would wrap the feet of his mule in pads and keep the axle of his cart extremely well greased so that he could move silently on late-night moonshine runs. In the daytime, his great-grandchildren loved jumping on that little wagon for a ride into town, and Michael and his older brothers sometimes amused themselves by teasing the hogs that the old man raised until he passed away in 1977, just days after Michael turned 14. Little did the Jordan boys realize that the mule and the hogs, indeed all the memories of their great-grandfather, were the trophies of a life well lived. As Michael explained years later, Dawson Jordan was not one to talk about the past or the significance of the animals. But even the casual mention many years later of Dawson Jordan could cause a tear to mist up in the eye of his famous great-grandson. "He was tough," Jordan would say of the old man. "He was that. Yes, he was." The River. You begin to gain the slightest sense of Dawson Jordan's world if you stand in the morning air along the northeast Cape Fear River in Holly Shelter. Today the place is mostly a rural game and wildlife preserve, but the light there was then, as it is now, harsh and blinding most days, dancing as it glints off the water, diffused only by patches of morning fog. To find relief, you have to push inland among the swamp forests and creeks to the solitude in the shadows once cast by the majestic virgin stands of longleaf pines. Dawson Jordan spent his youth there, working amidst the tar pits on the forest floors, taking down the last of the magnificent trees, bundling the logs into huge rafts, and floating them down the northeast Cape Fear River to the shipyards of Wilmington. It was no job for cowards. Dawson Jordan grew into manhood just after the turn of the 20th century, just as his old way of life on the river was fading, along with the last of the great longleaf pines and the arrival of the trucking industry. The ancient river and the dependable forests and woods had been the defining element in his young life. He knew how to hunt for wild game, knew how to clean what he killed and cook it up just right. Years later, as an old man, he would be employed by the region's hunting lodges to cook tasty wild game delights for its members. His working life began at age 9, when he convinced census workers he was 11 and old enough to head into the fields. He could already read and write, having attended the local one-room common school for coloreds, where the four-month academic year was frequently interrupted so the children could work in the fields or at the nearby sawmills. "My parents used to tell me how hard it was making them shingles at that mill," recalled Maurice Eugene Jordan, a distant relative who lived and farmed in Pender County. The students cut their own firewood and tended their own stove in the little schoolhouse, which was the standard even for the white children in their better-appointed schools. In those first decades of the 20th century, there was no electricity, little running water or plumbing, and few paved roads. And not surprisingly, there was almost no middle class, which meant that just about every male, black or white, spent his days in the desperate business of subsistence farming as sharecroppers and tenants and laborers, providing service to a select few landholders. An in-depth study of 1,000 farming families by North Carolina's Board of Agriculture in 1922 found that the state's sharecroppers earned less than 30 cents a day, sometimes as little as 10 cents, despite working long hours. The report added that most sharecroppers had no means of growing their own food and often needed to borrow money just to eat and pay the bills. Some 45,000 landless farm families lived in cramped one- and two-room shacks with no indoor plumbing and nothing but sheets of newspaper to cover cracks and holes in the walls and ceilings. Only a third of the sharecropper homes even had an outhouse. The unsanitary conditions explained to a large degree the high rate of disease and infant mortality among landless farm families, the report said, adding that the death rates for blacks more than doubled that for whites. Charlotte Hand and her son Dawson somehow managed to get by in these bleak circumstances with the help of the hands, who worked logging the river, and likely taught Dawson how to steer a raft. Family and community lore has it that he became very skilled at a young age. It wasn't easy building those huge log rafts and moving them down the treacherous river with its snakes, storm surges, and shifting tides. It took tremendous physical strength to steer a chain of 3 log rafts through the river's many bends and turns. But as perilous as it was, Dawson apparently relished the river, which was the main road of commerce for that era. Young Dawson worked with his cousin Galloway Jordan, who was also crippled. Maurice Eugene Jordan, a relative who lived and farmed in Pender County, recalled hearing his own father, Delmer Jordan, recount tales of Dawson Jordan. "They say he was real good with rafting those logs," Maurice Eugene Jordan remembered. "Galloway Jordan, he had a bad leg just like Dawson. They was real close." The northeast Cape Fear was a tidal river, which presented an extra challenge, Maurice explained. They had to watch out for them tides. They ran in and out, on a cycle with the moon. If the tide was high enough, they could make a move. But when the tide would get so weak, they'd have to tie their rafts off on a tree and wait for it to come back. The wait could take hours. They'd have pots and food, and when the tide was out, they'd tie off the rafts and get off on a hill and cook 'em up a little something to eat. It was cold, dangerous work that had been performed since colonial times by a mix of freed slaves, rafters, and roughnecks equal to the challenge. Those doing the work on the rivers inhabited the lowest rank in social class and were poorly paid, often making just a few cents a day, about the same as the lowliest sharecroppers. Still, Dawson Jordan seemed to enjoy the independence of working on the river. Census records list him as working on his own account rather than in the employ of someone else. In addition, the work offered the regular opportunity to ride down to the exotic port city of Wilmington, with its busy harbor full of ships and sailors from all over the world, and its many bars and bordellos. One can imagine Dawson Jordan sitting on his raft in a calm spot in the river on a cold, clear night a century ago, gazing up at the brilliant stars. It is likely that those nights on the river underneath the firmament offered young Dawson his only true moments of escape from a world that was often overwhelming. This was, perhaps, about as good as it got for Michael Jordan's great-grandfather. Decades later, his great-grandson would remark that his moments on the basketball court were his only haven, his only times of true peace, his singular escape from a world that was deeply troubling and far more frustrating than any of his millions of fans and followers could imagine. In very different ways, these two Jordans shared much across the span of a century, although their stations in the world were so vastly different. On many of his brutally difficult days, Dawson Jordan would certainly have loved just a taste of the sweet gravy of his great-grandson's lifestyle. Clementine. Unlike Michael, who would have his choice among legions of the planet's most sophisticated and attractive women, short, crippled Dawson lived in a small, isolated community with his mother while working long, dangerous days in the woods and on the river. He got a hint of what romance might be like when his mother found love at last with an older sharecropper in Holly. Isaac Keelan was 20 years her senior and well into his 60s when they married in May 1913, and their happiness must have served to spur on Dawson's thoughts about his own prospects. In time, despite the odds stacked against him, Dawson began to find favor with a girl named Clementine Burns. The song, "Oh My Darling Clementine," which had first gained wild popularity in 1884, probably factored into her naming at birth. She was a year older than Dawson and lived with her parents and seven younger siblings right there in Holly Shelter. In some regards, her prospects may have been as limited as his. Their courtship began, like all others in that day, with shy talk that grew bolder over time. Dawson was soon in love, never a casual thing for the deeply emotional Jordans. They exchanged vows in late January 1914 and began their lives together. About 8 months later, Clemmer, as she was known, told Dawson she was pregnant, and in April 1915 she delivered a strong, healthy boy in their tiny shack. They named him William Edward Jordan. There's every indication that the event brought immense happiness for the new father. If only that happiness could have lasted. The first signs of trouble came hard on the heels of the birth, the night sweats, and the urinary discomfort. Then Clemmer began coughing blood. The most telling symptom was the development of the tubercles themselves, the small rounded masses or nodules that attached themselves to bone and tendon. That was the black people's disease, tuberculosis, recalled Maurice Eugene Jordan. Back then, there wasn't too much they could do about it. The airborne disease was highly contagious, and though North Carolina was one of the first southern states to open a sanitarium for blacks in 1899, the privately financed facility had a mere dozen beds, and the cost was exorbitant. The only other option for the families was to set up a white-screened tent or temporary building in the yard outside their homes, which allowed loved ones to spend their last days close to family, with the hope of not spreading the tuberculosis. The demise of loved ones could drag on over agonizing months or years. Clemmer Jordan saw a doctor in the early stages of the disease, but died on an April morning in 1916, not long after her son's first birthday. It was not uncommon for a young widower to abandon his children in that era. It would have been simple enough for Dawson to allow Clemmer's family to raise the boy. Certainly, Dawson Jordan had his options. As a seaport, Wilmington was alive with opportunity to sign on as a cook with one of the many vessels coming and going. But the simple truth that emerges from the public records of his life was that he loved his mother very much, just as he loved his toddling son. That's what his action said, and his determination to build a family provided the first great fiber of strength in the story that would become Michael Jordan. A few months later, Dawson suffered another great blow when he learned that his mother, only in her late 40s, was dying of kidney disease. Death visited early and often on the coastal plain, but mortality rates doubled, then tripled and quadrupled in Pender County in 1917 and 1918 with a notorious Spanish flu epidemic. Dawson saw members of the Hand family, as well as his co-workers and their loved ones, pass in record numbers. In 90 days, between September and November of 1917, the influenza epidemic killed more than 13,000 North Carolinians. Dawson's mother's worsening disease necessitated her moving from Isaac Elon's home back in with her son. As her end neared and she could no longer help Dawson care for his young son, he took on a boarder, a young woman named Ethel Lane, who had a small daughter, and who was able to care for the children as well as for Charlotte. A short time later, Isaac Keelan died unexpectedly. They buried him, and 3 months later, Dawson's mother succumbed to her kidney disease. Dawson buried Charlotte Hand Keelan down by the river on Bannerman's Bridge Road in Holly. The boy who always wanted a family was now quite alone, except for the busy little child under his feet. Father and son would spend the rest of their lives together, living and working in one small shack after another in the same small coastal communities, pooling their resources to make their way in the face of poverty. The public record would eventually show that neither man acquired much of anything in life, yet time would reveal that they still bequeathed a great deal to the next generation. They did so despite another legacy lurking in the haze of Cape Fear, something insidious and even surreal. Chapter 2. Bloody Wilmington. The path back through yesteryear is one that Michael Jordan himself has taken often enough, back down through the country roads and simple memories of the Cape Fear coast. If you roll east down Interstate 40 out of Chapel Hill, the Piedmont gives way to the coastal plain, its rich, open fields bordered by a drab mix of scrub pines and decaying tobacco barns. Soon enough come signs for Teachy, then Wallace, and later Burgaw and Holly, the farming communities where the Jordan brand first took root many years ago. These days, the interstate highway system cloaks much of Cape Fear's disquieting legacy with miles of even pavement and clusters of gas stations and chain restaurants, relieved only by the faintest connection to Carolina's cultural past, an occasional barbecue stand. Nowhere, it seems, can you find mention now of the Democratic Party's white supremacy movement. But it was much in the air during Dawson Jordan's early years, and these ancient injuries, tied to events long ago in Old Wilmington, would surface in odd, ironic fashion in Michael Jordan's life. In the 1890s, Dixie Democrats had been able to reestablish white political control over much of the rest of North Carolina in the years following Reconstruction, but Wilmington and the coastal plain stood apart, largely on the strength of more than 120,000 black male registered voters. The place was on its way to becoming a peer of Atlanta with an emerging black upper class, two black newspapers, a black mayor, an integrated police force, and an array of black-owned businesses. The answer for Democrats was to foment rebellion in Wilmington with a race riot on November 11, 1898, in which whites, stirred by Democratic political rhetoric, took to the streets to burn the offices of a black newspaper that had dared to challenge the Democrats. Later that day, gunfire broke out, with armed whites, called red shirts, taking to the streets. The local morgue reported 14 bodies, 13 of them black, the next day, but others claimed the death toll ran as high as 90. As the violence spread, terrified blacks took their families and fled into the nearby swamps, where the red shirts were said to have followed to execute many more, whose remains were allegedly never recovered. The second phase of the well-planned rebellion began the next day, as whites escorted prominent blacks, clergymen, business leaders, politicians, to the local train station and packed them out of town for good. The resounding victory for white supremacy would secure the doctrine for decades to come. Charles Aycock, elected governor in 1900, set a legislative agenda that followed through on the riot's violent message. There shall be no progress in the South for either race until the Negro is removed permanently from the political process, Aycock had declared. The backbone of the plan was to limit voter registration with a literacy test, and the number of black males in North Carolina voting rosters quickly plummeted to fewer than 6,000 from better than 120,000 before the riot. Such inequity and violence had the tacit backing of state and local law enforcement, with strong intimidation by other forces as well. By the 1940s and 1950s, there were only two black voters registered in all of Duplin County, where Jordan's family lived, according to Raphael Carlton, one of those two registered voters. The son of a sharecropper, Raphael Carlton worked as a contemporary of the Jordans in Duplin as a young man, even as his father insisted he allow time for school. Carlton eventually went to nearby Shaw University, earning his teaching degree in the 1940s, and returned home as part of a generation of dedicated black educators. He recalled attending a black faculty meeting at the height of segregation. The local school system's white superintendent stood up and told his black teachers, "You niggers better get your act together." "People in modern times don't understand how we could be so intimidated back then," Carlton said. "But the intimidation was complete. You didn't dare challenge them." Changing the mindset. In 1937, John McClendon was hired to coach basketball at the North Carolina College for Negroes, later to become North Carolina Central University, in Durham. He was astounded by the beaten-down mindset of his young players. "My biggest challenge as coach," McClendon recounted, "was to convince my players that they were not inferior athletes. Even the black population didn't know it and didn't believe. They had succumbed to the one-sided propaganda." The coach's mere presence in North Carolina served to highlight yet another major influence in Michael Jordan's life, one that also had come to being in 1891. Just 5 months after the birth of Jordan's great-grandfather, James Naismith nailed up a peach basket in a gymnasium in Springfield, Massachusetts, thus beginning the age of basketball. Decades later, Naismith would move to the University of Kansas as a member of the education faculty, where he coached the university team for a while before turning it over to Fogg Allen, who would come to be considered the father of basketball coaching. John McClendon had come to Kansas in the early 1930s as one of the university's first black students, but he was barred by Allen from competing on the basketball team and from swimming in the university pool. The situation would have been far worse for the black student if Naismith himself had not sought him out and arranged for McClendon to coach a local high school team while he earned his undergraduate degree at Kansas. After McClendon graduated in 1936, Naismith helped him obtain a scholarship to earn a master's degree at the University of Iowa. Finishing his graduate studies in a year, McClendon took the coaching job at Little North Carolina College, where he founded the first physical education program that began training generations of black teachers and coaches in North Carolina. That program would produce Clifton Pop Herring, Jordan's high school coach. The early black college teams operated on shoestring budgets in the dangerous climate of segregation. They achieved success despite a culture that made travel nearly impossible, with no public restrooms, drinking fountains, restaurants, or hotels available to them. "A simple trip from one school to another was like plotting your way through a minefield," McClendon said. Over the next few years, McClendon put together such impressive teams that officials at nearby Duke University were inspired to issue an invitation for the young coach to sit on the Blue Devils' bench during an upcoming game. The only stipulation, they said, was that McClendon would have to wear a white jacket so that he would appear to the crowd to be a steward. McClendon politely declined. The coach vowed never to put himself or his players in any circumstance where they might be disrespected or humiliated. "You did not want to get into a situation where your dignity would be destroyed right in front of your team," he explained. Maintaining his players' respect was critical in convincing them that they were every bit as good as whites. A breakthrough came during World War II, when the military used Duke University's medical school to train wartime physicians, several of whom were top-notch basketball players. The all-white med school team's wins were trumpeted daily in the Durham papers. Meanwhile, McClendon's undefeated team received no publicity. Upset over the disparity, Alex Rivera, McClendon's team manager, arranged for the two teams to play a game. With the Klan vigilant to bar such a mixing of the races, the Duke coach agreed to a secret game on a Sunday morning with no fans or media allowed. By halftime, McClendon's pressing, full-court team had doubled the score on its high-profile opponents. That's when the white players approached McClendon's bench and suggested that they evenly divide the roster among blacks and whites to compete in the second half. It was the first great victory for McClendon against racism, one that opened his players' eyes. Long after he had departed, McClendon's influence was felt in North Carolina, first in the prominence of basketball in black communities across the state, and then more significantly at the college level. A highly innovative coach, McClendon was invited by the Converse Shoe Company to teach at its coaching clinics. It was at one of McClendon's clinic presentations that a young assistant coach at the Air Force Academy named Dean Smith got his first blueprint for the famed four-corner spread offense, which Smith confirmed in a 1991 interview. McClendon and his friend Big House Gaines of Winston-Salem State came to be viewed as lions of the coaching business. But at the time, neither coach could have fathomed that their sport would also help break down the state's racial barriers. Never could the coaches have imagined that in their lifetimes, black and white North Carolinians would embrace a black player the way they would embrace Michael Jordan. Nor could the coaches have dreamed that they themselves would one day become members of the Basketball Hall of Fame, named for James Naismith. The Corn. Over his long lifetime, Dawson Jordan encountered none of the good timing that would mark his great-grandson's experience. By the time Dawson turned 28, he had not only suffered great personal loss, but had been forced to change careers with the disappearance of log rafting and the birth of the trucking industry. While he continued working at the local lumber mills, Dawson Jordan also became a sharecropper, like the majority of the southern population, the lowest on society's totem pole for that era. The critical element to survival on rented land was the mule. As such, the animal carried a status, as explained by a cousin, William Henry Jordan. When I was a child, a mule cost more than a car, because you had to make a living with a mule. As farmers in later generations would purchase farm equipment, the sharecroppers and tenant farmers bought and rented mules from local dealers. Maurice Eugene Jordan recalled, "You could get a mule from the mule dealer, but if you had a bad year, he'd come and get that mule. The seed and fertilizer man you borrowed from would do the same. You catch a bad season and get in a hole, it could take a year or two to get out. You didn't have a choice," explained William Henry Jordan. "You didn't have anything else." For men like Dawson Jordan and his son, there was no escape from the circumstances, but they somehow managed to keep themselves fed. Sometimes they worked early mornings, milking at a nearby dairy farm, then taking the cows out to graze. In the leanest times, a farmer might slip from tenant farming, where he leased land and handled everything himself, back into sharecropping. "That's where you would furnish the labor," William Henry Jordan explained, "and the people who owned the farm would furnish the mule, the seed, and the fertilizer. At the end of the season, you'd get a third to half of what was left over. Lots of times, there was nothing left over." That's why many farmers looked to other sources of income, and why moonshining became so important to so many of them. Farmers, both black and white, of the coastal plain had been making their own corn liquor as far back as the colonial era. Most of them certainly didn't have the money to buy it, so they made their own. "Since way back, that's about all it was corn liquor," explained Maurice Eugene Jordan. "So there was a lot of moonshine. They'd have them stills everywhere, on the river, in the woods, in the swamps, wherever the water was good." It's unlikely that Dawson Jordan ever intentionally set out to be a moonshiner, but he soon gained a reputation as a prominent figure in Pender County's illegal trade. Perhaps he first got into the business when he was working logs on the river. "Those rafts might have been full of whiskey," Maurice Jordan said with a knowing laugh. Nobody could tell what they were hauling. Corn liquor perhaps relieved the hardship a little. It certainly loosened up the atmosphere on long nights, making the conservative farmers amenable to a little gaming. The hard-working men of Pender County would roll the bones for a few pennies, nothing like the huge sums that Michael would wager decades later. "Nobody had nothing to gamble with," Maurice Eugene Jordan said. "Wasn't no gambling but to shoot a little dice." That was the Jordan character. Work hard and pick your spots for recreation. In that regard, too, Dawson Jordan was first in a line of Jordan men. He knew how to turn to the devil's playground for a little fun. He liked a little drink, a little smoke, and perhaps a wee bit of action on a slow Carolina night. The New Generation. As he gained adulthood in the 1930s, Dawson's son William Edward came to be known as Medward. He found work driving a truck for a landscaping company. While he still helped his father farm, his modest salary meant they were no longer dependent solely on the ups and downs of a cropper's life. Driving the small dump truck around the area to deliver landscaping materials also brought Medward a newfound status and the opportunity to meet people, a fairly dramatic change from the isolated life of a farmer. He became known as something of a ladies' man in the community, according to family members. In his late teens, he took up with a pretty young woman named Rosabel Hand, a distant relative on his mother's side of the family. She became his wife in 1935, and 2 summers later, a son was born, Michael's father. They named him James Raymond Jordan. The couple would live for decades with Dawson Jordan, yet never seemed to rebel against his commanding presence in their cramped household, the same one in which Michael Jordan and his siblings would grow up. Rosabel was as sweet and soft-spoken as her father-in-law was sonorous. As he neared 50, Dawson took more and more to walking with a cane, but his word ruled the Jordan household. As with most farming families, financial difficulty remained a steady companion for the Jordans, but they never seemed to allow that to affect their lives too deeply, family members recalled. Perhaps it was because Dawson had learned early in life that there were far worse things than coming up a little short on cash to pay the bills. When financial trouble struck hard enough, he finally did what other poor sharecroppers and tenant farmers had done. He packed up the wagon, hitched the mule, and moved on. He didn't have to go far for a fresh start. Dawson, his son, his pregnant daughter-in-law, and their small son settled in the farming community of Teachy, a mere 25 miles from Holly Shelter. Not long after they moved in, Rosabel gave birth to a second son, Gene. In all, Rosabel Hand Jordan bore 4 children for Medward, and they in turn would produce 12 grandchildren who regularly populated the modest household. In time, the Jordan saved enough through Medward's work to purchase a tiny, inexpensive house on Calico Bay Road, just outside of Teachy. It had 3 small bedrooms and an outhouse, but it was a castle for Dawson Jordan and his family. It would also serve as the center of young Michael Jordan's world. Before long, the Jordans purchased additional lots along Calico Bay Road as they continued to prosper with Medward's work and Dawson's moonshining, and the area blossomed into a small residential community. The emotional significance the property held for the family can be gauged by the fact that decades later, the Jordans, despite all of Michael's wealth, maintained ownership of the house and leased it out as a rental property. Along with their new prosperity, the most important shift in the lives of Dawson and his son was the presence of the deeply spiritual Rosabel Jordan. She shared an abundance of love with all her children and grandchildren, and even the children her husband fathered in his dalliances around the community. Ms. Bell, as she was often called, seemed to be especially proud of her oldest son. There was just something different about James Raymond Jordan. He had a special light and energy. For starters, he was plenty smart. By age 10, he was driving a tractor to help his father in the field and showing him how to fix it when it broke down. By the time he was a young man, he had impressed the entire community with his mechanical abilities and dexterity. Medward was said to be openly negative toward James, but the boy idolized his grandfather Dawson. One of James's traits was the intense concentration he'd reveal by sticking out his tongue as he focused on a task. According to some in the family, sticking out the tongue was something James picked up from Dawson. As he grew from a child into a teen, working alongside his father and grandfather, James moved easily in both Holly, where he was born, and in Teachy, where he grew up. He was kind of quiet, recalled Maurice Eugene Jordan, who attended Charity High School in Rose Hill with James. If he didn't know you, he didn't do a whole lot of woofing. However, if James knew you, he could be charming, especially with the ladies, just like his father Medward. Like a lot of teens, he loved engines and baseball and automobiles, except that James was really good with all of them, which meant that he usually had working transportation, conferring a special status on the teenaged James Jordan in the 1950s. He also had a taste for fun and knew where to find it on those nights when the full moon rose up and spilled its light across the coastal plain. While many blacks in the region sought to avoid white people wherever possible, that was not the way of Dawson or his grandson James. Times remained hard for blacks in the 1950s. Many had served their country well in World War II, which in turn had encouraged the slightest loosening of the country's negative mindset. Yet the old attitude still held a grip on North Carolina society, as the coming struggle for civil rights would soon demonstrate. Dick Nayer, a young white Marine from Indiana, married a local girl and settled in Wilmington in 1954. Nayer loved baseball, as did the nearby town of Wallace, so sometimes Nayer would pick up some black guys he knew to ride up there to play. It's likely that Nayer played against James Jordan in the 1950s in Wallace. He didn't play there long, however. Nayer returned home one evening to find a pickup truck parked in his yard. Klan members were there to warn him about riding around with blacks and playing in mixed baseball games. Nayer ignored the warning, but Klan members returned to his house. That second time, they told him they wouldn't warn him again. Nayer stopped going to Wallace to play baseball. He stayed in Wilmington, though, and much later became Michael Jordan's youth baseball coach. In such an atmosphere, Dawson Jordan and his family remained far too challenged by day-to-day living to place any sort of real trust in the future. Even so, family members and neighbors saw that James Jordan represented a generation that just might be able to move beyond the old world to something newer and better. Little did anyone understand in the early 1950s what that newness might look like, or the strange ways it would blend hope and hurt. The easy assumption is that if the Jordans had only known the unimaginable things that the future held, they might have run toward it. Just as likely, some family members would later say, they might have fled. Part 2. Early Times. Chapter 3. The Influence. If his great-grandfather Dawson Jordan first stoked the furnace of Michael's life, it was Michael's mother, Dolores Peoples, who brought fiery propulsion to the mix. She was born in September 1941 into a relatively prosperous family in Rocky Point, North Carolina. Her father, Edward Peoples, was a distant, some would say humorless man, known for his ambition and hard work. Among the many frustrated and penniless black farmers, a generation of men who spent their lives in overalls, confounded by an economic system that almost guaranteed their failure, Edward Peoples found rare success. "I knew her father," recalled Maurice Eugene Jordan. "Old man Edward Peoples. He didn't sharecrop, he had his own farm." Denied any sort of access to the politics of that era, Edward Peoples was one of a number of North Carolina's blacks who had focused instead on economic advancement. A Black Wall Street flourished in nearby Durham under the leadership of John Merrick, who founded several insurance companies and banks. Edward Peoples' modest success was nothing on that scale, but the record indicates that he was tireless in his focus on making money. In addition to his farming, Dolores' father also worked for Casey Lumber Company in Rocky Point, and his wife Inez labored as a domestic. While they were not wealthy, the Peoples were far from poor. Theirs had been a determined progress through the hazards and pitfalls that claimed so many farmers, white or black, in the early decades of the 20th century. Like the Jordans, the Peoples had found their share of heartaches in that era of disease and death. Still, they became landowners, free to farm for their own interests. Although the Peoples are little known and seldom mentioned in the Jordan story, there's no question that the family's drive and work ethic factored into Michael's mother's approach to her own life, and then to that of her famous son. The Jordan family fable has been told again and again, but it is a false narrative in many key aspects, which is understandable. Whenever families have found immense fame and fortune in the spotlight, they've quickly constructed such mythologies. They've often done this out of self-preservation, to protect family members from the all-consuming media-driven pop culture. Dolores Jordan had to shield her family from many situations as her son became famous in the 1980s. So it's not surprising that she began the creation of such a narrative, one that omitted or glossed over many hard facts. She did this first in interviews and later in her book, Family First, which offered child-rearing advice, by implication, on how families could raise their children to be like Mike. The best-selling book would enable Mrs. Jordan to travel the world, making public appearances in support of family issues. The reality of Dolores Jordan is so much more powerful than the made-up story because it reveals her character and, later in her life, her ability to move her own family through brutal circumstances. There's little question that the obstacles Dolores Jordan faced fired her efforts in raising her family. As a result, they also provided the very fuel of Air Jordan. Rocky Point. Appropriately, the families that would become Michael Jordan's gene pool first met on the hardwood in a cramped gym filled with cheering students. According to vague community and family memories, James and his younger brother Gene Jordan played for Charity High. Dolores' brothers, Edward and Eugene Peoples, played for the Rocky Point Training School of Pender County. The two schools enjoyed a rivalry back in those days, and folks in the community recall that the Peoples boys were good players. They also recall the love students and faculty had for Rocky Point. Opened in 1917, it was one of 5,000 schools, shops, and teachers' homes built for African Americans in communities across the country with money provided by the Rosenwald Fund, a trust set up by Sears Roebuck & Company President Julius Rosenwald. The equipment wasn't always the best. Used furniture and books, often with pages torn out, were passed down from the county's white schools. "We got what they had worn out," recalled William Henry Jordan, a relative of the family. But in an age when black education was at best an afterthought for local school boards, the school's dedicated teachers prepared students for every sort of challenge, which made Rocky Point important to the African-American population of Pender County right up until integration in the late 1960s. Basketball games were played after school in a space cleared in the school's auditorium, and usually lasted until the early evening. Dolores originally told reporters that the contest that brought her and James together occurred in 1956 when she was 15. However, she corrected that miscalculation in Family First, explaining that in fact she first met her husband after a 1954 game. She was barely 13 years old at the time and was truly excited to be a part of the school spirit at Rocky Point. She was pert and spunky, but a good girl too. She prayed often and went to church regularly with her family. "She was a good student when I taught her," recalled Mary Faison, a former faculty member at Rocky Point. It's not clear whether James played on Charity's team that night. He was 17 and a senior, and he was there with a car, which was indicative of the Jordans' improving financial situation as well as his strong mechanical bent. As in many teen love stories, she noticed him before he was aware of her. He had doe-like eyes and high cheekbones, but that wasn't what captured her fancy. "What attracted me was his personality," she explained. "As far as looks, it was no more than some of the other guys. He was outgoing, had a good sense of humor, and was a caring, kind person." Dolores and several of her cousins jumped in the back seat of his car to get a ride home after the game. When it appeared that he was going to drive right past her house, she called out for him to stop. "Oh, I didn't realize I had somebody else in here," he said. "You're pretty cute." "You're pretty fresh," she supposedly retorted. "Could be, but someday I'll marry you," he replied, according to her recollection. "I knew he was going out with somebody else," she said. "I stayed away from him." Dolores ran into her house and slammed the door behind her, as 13-year-old girls are wont to do. In that small community, James Jordan was likely already aware that Edward Peoples farmed his own land, and he had to have noticed the girl's house, which was larger than most. It was a two-story frame house that sat back from the road. "There was a lot of big old shade trees in the yard," recalled Maurice Eugene Jordan. "A lot of colored Peoples were just farm labor back then," he added, explaining that the industrious Edward Peoples kept his own land busy year-round, all the while working at Casey Lumber Company. Beyond his farming, he invested time and money in another cash crop, just as so many of his neighbors did. Edward Peoples was a moonshiner. In fact, Peoples was said to be close with David Jordan, one of Dawson Jordan's many moonshining cousins. As Maurice Eugene Jordan explained, they had quite a few stills. The revenuers would find them, tear them up, but they'd go right back at it. The key was not to get caught. It wasn't long before James approached Edward Peoples about dating Lois, as he called her. A hard-working, no-nonsense man, Peoples didn't think much of the idea. "She wasn't old enough," he said. "Young love, not to mention ambition, has long had a mind of its own, however." The two were soon seeing each other despite her parents' wishes. "We quickly fell in love and dated for the next 3 years," Dolores remembered. The The relationship lost little steam even when James finished school in 1955 and joined the Air Force, making his father and grandfather quite proud. James underwent training in Texas while Dolores's family had sent her off to Alabama to live with an uncle and take classes in a 2-year cosmetology program. She has said that the move was made as an attempt to slow things down with a young airman, but the relationship had already hit its own warp speed. By early 1957, she was 15 and pregnant, a fact she didn't acknowledge in her own memoir, and dealing with the fallout of her family's anger. The sudden enrollment in Alabama seemed a typical solution at a time when a pregnant teen was often sent away to have her child. That April, both James and Dolores were back in Pender County and went to a movie together, ostensibly to sort out their situation. The resolution came when he proposed in his car after the show. Once James did the right thing, she informed her parents that she would not be returning to Alabama, another decision that apparently didn't sit well. Years later, she would remark that her mother should have insisted she go back to school. "My mother should have put me right back on the train," Dolores once told a reporter. Instead, she moved into her fiancé's crowded family home in Teachy, where Dawson Jordan, now 66, still very much ruled the roost. There, the pregnant teenager soon formed a lasting friendship with Rosabel Jordan, who had just turned 40. A devout and worldly woman, James's mother loved children, loved filling the little house with relatives and friends on holidays and weekends. Dolores took to calling her Ms. Bell, and in a time when things were so strained with her own parents, Dolores found a wise and nurturing older soul. The friendship between the two women would grow into one of the tight family bonds that helped shape Michael Jordan's later success. James and Dolores soon celebrated the birth of their first child, James Ronald, that September. The mother, who had just turned 16, held her baby close and wondered what the world would hold for him. In time, the infant would grow into the sort of industrious young man that her own father had been. Ronnie, as they would call him, held down 2 jobs in high school, driving a school bus and managing a local restaurant in the evenings, all while excelling in junior ROTC and making his parents proud. This first son, it seems, had drawn on Dawson Jordan's commanding presence. He would go on to a distinguished career as a master sergeant in the U.S. Army with multiple tours of combat duty. Dolores brought the new baby into the already crowded Jordan household. James had been assigned to a base in Tidewater, Virginia, a little better than 2 hours away, and came home on weekend leave to see his young son. Dolores would later admit that this was when she entertained the first doubt and self-recrimination about the turn of events in her life. She longed to see her own family more, but they were almost a half hour away in Rocky Point. She kept faith, and her new mother-in-law helped her remain positive. James did his part as well, determined that his service experience would start him on a path to becoming the sort of breadwinner who could provide a middle-class upbringing for his own children. Brooklyn, then Teachy. James Jordan's young family welcomed their second child, Dolores, in 1959. Early in her life, the child would go by Dolores as a given name before settling on Dolores as an adult. For clarity's sake, in the early years, the family called her Sis. That same year, James left the Air Force and returned to Teachy, where he took a job at a local textile plant. For the time being, the young family crowded in with his parents until they could build a small home right across Calico Bay Road from Dawson, Medward, and Rosabel. It was handy to have grandparents close by, as Dolores Jordan would give birth to 5 children by the time she reached 23. In the early years, much of the burden of child-rearing fell to Rosabel, who wanted nothing more than to shower love on each new grandbaby that came along. As strong as the bonds of the extended Jordan family were, Dolores's time away in Alabama and James's stint in the Air Force had opened their eyes to the world beyond North Carolina. And so it happened that even as they were building their house across Calico Bay Road from his parents, they began to realize that deep down, they wanted something more beyond the offerings of the little farming communities of Teachy and Wallace. In that regard, they were no different from millions of others of their generation. African Americans, in particular, were drawing the first breaths of a new air after suffocating for so long. The serf systems of sharecropping and tenant farming had begun to die off in the wake of the Great Depression and World War II, which hastened the movement of millions of rural blacks to cities, particularly in the North, in search of new economic survival. The March to Freedom picked up its pace on February 1, 1960, when four black students from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University went to a Woolworth store in Greensboro, bought a few things, then sat at the lunch counter and ordered coffee. Their simple act rang across North Carolina. The store's management ignored the students, so they sat there in silence until closing time. The next morning, the A&T students returned with five friends and again sought service at the lunch counter. Met again with management silence, the students began what they described as a sit-in, a quiet, non-violent demonstration. White youths soon showed up to taunt them and flick cigarette butts at them, but similar protests appeared in Winston-Salem, Durham, Charlotte, Raleigh, and High Point, and then it spread to 15 cities and many more Woolworth stores across the country, all in a matter of about 2 weeks. Woolworth's, a national chain, soon relented and began serving black customers at its lunch counters. The company was clearly unwilling to perpetuate racism in the public spotlight before network TV cameras. The unfolding civil rights movement was but one part of the tremendous cultural upheaval affecting the country. With that change came new promise for life itself, and James and Dolores couldn't help but share in that expectation. It was an exciting time, yet confusing, and still quite dangerous. Dolores delivered the couple's second son, Larry, in early 1962. 2 months later, she learned that yet another child was on the way. Shortly thereafter, the 21-year-old Dolores and her husband scooped up baby Larry and headed to Brooklyn, New York, where they would live for almost 2 years, as James went to trade school on the GI Bill to learn to build, repair, and maintain hydraulic equipment, a logical extension of his Air Force training. The move required their leaving their two oldest children, both under age 5 and still in their formative years, in the care of the Jordan grandparents for almost 2 years. Later, Dolores Jordan would remark that in essence, she and James had two families, the older children who remained behind, and the younger children. This would come to create no small gulf in their family. As joyful as the new additions would be, they were tempered by heartbreak. The Jordans hadn't been in New York more than a few weeks when Dolores received the news that her mother, Inez, had died suddenly. The shock of the loss and the instant torrent of grief staggered Dolores and imperiled her unborn baby. Her doctor ordered bed rest for a week. "The near miscarriage was very bad," James Jordan recalled years later. Relations had improved between Dolores and her mother since the difficult period of her early pregnancy and marriage, but unresolved issues remained, as is so often the case with the sudden premature death of a loved one. Dolores's grief was compounded by her precarious pregnancy and her situation far away from home in a crowded, alien city. Michael Jordan's delivery was a particularly hectic scene that Sunday, February 17, 1963. Dolores had gone into labor a bit early, which was how she wound up at Cumberland Hospital in Brooklyn, even though her doctor was in Manhattan. Even before the hospital attendants could get Dolores onto an emergency room gurney, the large, strapping male child made his startling appearance, clogged with mucus and struggling to breathe. "When Michael was born, we thought there might be something wrong with him," James Jordan revealed years later in an interview with the Chicago Tribune. "He was born with a nosebleed. The hospital kept him 3 days after Dolores was discharged. He'd have nosebleeds for no reason until he was 5, and then they just stopped." After Michael's birth, the doctors did keep him a couple of days to be sure that his lungs were clear of some mucus, his mother recalled. "In many ways, the arrival helped punctuate her months of grief. I've always said that Michael's birth was like a sign," she later explained. "I lost my mother unexpectedly while carrying Michael, and he was my godsend. Michael was the happiness he sent me at a very sad time in my life." Michael himself would learn some details of his birth years later from Chicago newspaper reporters, who had gathered them from his family. "My nose still bleeds easily," he told Bob Sakamoto of the Tribune. "That's one story my mom never told me. The only thing my mom told me was the time when I fell behind the bed as a baby and almost suffocated. There have been some very close calls in terms of my life." The near suffocation, which happened after the family returned to North Carolina, only served to raise his mother's anxiety levels over her special gift. "He was such a jolly baby," she remembered. "He never cried. Just feed him and give him something to play with, and he was fine." By the time Michael was 5 months old, the family had retreated from Brooklyn back to their home on Calico Bay Road in Teachy. They made the move with Dolores pregnant one final time. Daughter Rosalind was on the way. And back home, James put his education to use as a maintenance employee for the General Electric plant in Castlehaine, near Wilmington. Soon, the young mother found herself in the small house with five children, four of them under the age of five. Her husband called her Lois, as did the rest of the family, and her term of endearment for him was Ray. He cut an impressive figure in the small farming community, with his Air Force experience and his job at GE. Although generally warm and friendly, he began to show a harsher side as well. He proved to be a stern taskmaster with children, whether they were his own or somebody else's. Word soon enough got out among the neighborhood children. Ray didn't play. He'd whip your butt in a minute. Young Michael would spend his formative years on sleepy little Calico Bay Road. By all accounts, he was easy to laugh, eager to please, and hungry to entertain, which also earned him his share of spankings. You had to discipline him, Dolores Jordan once remembered. He would test you to the limit. Michael was always getting into things. As a two-year-old, he wandered outside one late afternoon while his father worked on an auto in the family's backyard and used a lamp powered by two extension cords stretched across the damp ground from the kitchen. Before his father could stop him, the toddler grabbed the two cords at their juncture. The ensuing shock knocked young Michael back 3 feet, leaving him stunned but otherwise unhurt. Already strict with their children, the Jordans were prompted by the incident to tighten their control. No one was to leave the house under any circumstances without permission, and each night the children had to be in bed by 8 o'clock, no matter if others in the neighborhood were still outside playing. But it soon became evident that Michael's bountiful nature could not be contained as he grew into childhood. One time he found trouble under his granddaddy Dawson's wagon with a wasp's nest that he attempted to douse with gasoline. That was followed by his adventure with a stack of lawn chairs he piled amazingly high to demonstrate his flying prowess. He suffered a long cut on his arm from that one. James Jordan couldn't wait for his boys to be big enough to hold a bat. He was always eager to get them into the backyard so he could toss a baseball their way and teach them how to swing. One day Michael was swinging away with a bat at a block of wood with a nail in it, only to discover that the missile had struck his older sister in the head and stuck there. Perhaps the biggest trouble came at age 4, when he slipped away from the house and crossed the road to his grandparents' place, where he found an older cousin chopping wood. Little Mike hoisted the axe a time or two, and the cousin said he'd give him a dollar to chop off his own toe. Eager to impress, he raised the axe and let it fall, just on the tip, then immediately howled in pain and took off back across the road, hopping and screaming and bleeding the whole way home to his mother. He was a mischievous child, James Jordan would later remember, with a smile. Sis, the older girl in the family, recalled that her parents had their favorites. She and Larry were her father's pets, while Ronnie and little Mike, born just 11 months apart, could do no wrong in their mother's eyes. Roz, the baby of the family, had everyone's undivided affection. Young Michael Jordan faced much competition for attention in that busy household, and a lifelong dynamic was set in place. He was always eager to please, first his parents and family, and later his coaches and an adoring public. He mastered the art of entertaining and spent hours amusing us, remembered Sis of those early years, dancing, singing, teasing, or whatever it took to bring a smile, grin, or laugh, he did. And never content to play by himself, he always needed an audience and would not let us ignore him no matter how hard we tried. Moving again. Michael's idyllic early childhood in Teachy was not easy to come by in 1960s America, but circumstances changed dramatically before he started kindergarten in the fall of 1968. In January that year, James and Dolores Jordan sold their house in Teachy, packed up the family, and moved to Wilmington, about 60 miles away on the coast. One reason for the move was that James had tired of his 40-minute commute to the GE plant in Castlehaine each day. But more importantly, as Dolores Jordan would explain later, the family longed for something beyond the rural life. They wanted more for their children, too. They remained quite close to the grandparents and planned to make frequent visits to Wallace and Teachy. In particular, they promised to return at least one weekend a month to attend services at Rockfish African Methodist Episcopal Church, the Jordan family's place of worship for decades. They hardly had time to unpack their things in Wilmington when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated,